Do you think that's some information I would like to know?
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, hour three is here. It goes by so fast. And I realize some of you have been trying to get on the air and you got a busy signal. So please give me a call, 888-914-9149. I'd love to talk to you, 888-914-9149. A few quick things I want to get to. There is some new artificial intelligence news to share with you. A group of researchers in Spain have designed an algorithm that can detect atrial fibrillation, an arrhythmia that can lead to a stroke. And this is in El País, which is the major newspaper in Madrid, Spain. So they start off with the question, what if you could know if you have a high probability of having a stroke in the next 2 years? A group of researchers from the hospital, a particular hospital in Madrid, they are working on predicting and preventing it. They've designed an algorithm that predicts whether a patient will develop this atrial fibrillation, a common arrhythmia among the population. 20% of those over 80 suffer from it, and one of its most serious consequences can be stroke. So in the article, which is translated from the Spanish, if you're interested in how they're using this and how it might become available here in the U.S., they say it's very cheap technology. It costs around 50 cents per test. 50 cents per test. And it is a test that in conjunction with an EKG can give much more information about what's going on in the heart than previously understood, and can be a very strong indicator of whether or not a stroke might be in the future. So if this interests you, and I think it should interest most people, have a look at that. You'll find it on the show Twitter feed, at P Madrid Show. Also, a little article here that I want to share with you. This appeared, and what caught my eye about this is it appeared in Newsweek. Now, it's an opinion piece, but Newsweek, of all places, you know, definitely left of center, I was surprised that they ran this. So let me share this with you. It's called How Fauci Fooled America. When the pandemic hit, America needed someone to turn to for advice. The media and the public naturally looked to Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, an esteemed laboratory immunologist and one of President Trump's chosen COVID advisors. Unfortunately, Dr. Fauci got major epidemiology and public health questions wrong. Reality and scientific studies have now caught up with him. Here are the key issues. Natural immunity. By pushing vaccine mandates, Dr. Fauci ignores naturally acquired immunity among the COVID recovered, of which there are more than 45 million in the United States. I suspect the figure's higher than that, but let's say 45 million. Mounting evidence indicates that natural immunity is stronger and longer lasting than vaccine-induced immunity. And let's see, the editor says they inserted this editorial comment in the article. It says, long-term trends are still unclear. A recent study reached the opposite conclusion, but was criticized by an author of this op-ed. They point out that in a study from Israel, the vaccinated were 27 times more likely to get symptomatic COVID than unvaccinated people who had recovered from a prior COVID infection. They say, we have known about natural immunity from disease at least since the Athenian plague in 430 BC. Pilots, truckers, longshoremen, and others know about it. Nurses know about it better than anyone. Under Fauci's mandates, hospitals are firing heroic nurses who recovered from COVID when they contracted it while caring for patients. With their superior immunity, they can safely care for the oldest and frailest of patients with even lower transmission risk than the vaccinated. Another point they bring up, protecting the elderly. While anyone can get infected, there is more than a thousand-fold difference in mortality risk between the old and the young. After more than 700,000 reported COVID deaths in America, we now know that lockdowns fail to protect high-risk older people. When confronted with the idea of focused protection of the vulnerable, Dr. Fauci admitted he had no idea how to accomplish it, arguing that it would be impossible. That may be understandable for a lab scientist, but public health scientists have presented many concrete suggestions that could have helped had Fauci and other officials not ignored them. What can we do now to minimize COVID mortality? Current vaccination efforts should focus on reaching people over 60 who are neither COVID recovered nor vaccinated, including hard-to-reach, less affluent people in rural areas and inner cities. Instead, Dr. Fauci has pushed vaccine mandates for children, students, and working-age adults who are already immune. all low-risk populations, causing tremendous disruption to labor markets and hampering the operation of many hospitals. Another point, school closures. Schools are major transmission points for influenza, but not for COVID. While children do get infected, their risk for COVID death is minuscule, lower than their already low risk of dying from the flu. Throughout the 2020 spring wave, Sweden kept daycare and schools open for all of its 1.8 million children, ages 1 to 15, with no masks, no testing, no social distancing. The result? Zero COVID deaths among children and a COVID risk to teachers lower than the average of other professions. In fall of 2020, most European countries followed suit with similar results. Considering the devastating effects of school closures on children, Dr. Fauci's advocacy for school closures may be the single biggest mistake of his career. Next point, masks. The gold standard of medical research is randomized trials, and there have now been two on COVID masks for adults. For children, there is no solid scientific basis that masks work. A Danish study found no statistically significant difference between masking and not masking when it comes to coronavirus infection. In a study in Bangladesh, the 95% confidence interval shows that masks reduce transmission between 0% and 18%. Hence, masks are either of zero or limited benefit. There are many more critical pandemic measures that Dr. Fauci could have emphasized, such as better ventilation in schools and hiring nursing home staff with natural immunity. Contact tracing. For some infectious diseases, such as Ebola and syphilis, contact tracing is critically important. For a commonly circulating viral infection such as COVID, it is a hopeless waste of valuable public health resources that did not stop the disease. Next point, or nearing the conclusion here, collateral public health damage. A fundamental public health principle is that health is multidimensional. The control of a single infectious disease is not synonymous with health. As an immunologist, Dr. Fauci failed to properly consider and weigh the disastrous effects of lockdowns and the effects they would have on cancer detection and treatment, cardiovascular disease outcomes, diabetes care, childhood vaccination rates, mental health, and opioid overdoses, to name a few. Americans will live with and die from this collateral damage for many years to come. And here's the conclusion. In private conversations, most of our scientific colleagues agree with us on these points. While a few have spoken up, why are not more doing so? Well, some tried but failed. Others kept silent when they saw colleagues being slandered and smeared in the media or censored by big tech. Some are government employees who are barred from contradicting official policy. Many are afraid of losing positions or research grants. Aware that Dr. Fauci sits on top of the largest pile of infectious disease research money in the world. Most scientists are not experts on infectious disease outbreaks. Were we, say, oncologists, physicists, or botanists, we would probably also have trusted Dr. Fauci. The evidence is in. Governors, journals, scientists, university presidents, hospital administrators, and business leaders can continue to follow Dr. Fauci or open their eyes. After 700,000 plus COVID deaths and the devastating effects of lockdowns, it is time to return to the basic principles of public health. And as I say, that appeared in Newsweek in just the last several days. And we have a link to that if you want to look at the scientific and medical background of the men who wrote this article and the links to the other things that they link to in the article. You'll find it there at the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. Back to the phones. Let's go to Debbie now in New Orleans. Good morning, Debbie.
My question is about the bishops in Germany blessing gay marriages. That's clearly against the teaching of the church. What can and will be done to stop that?
Probably nothing.
Oh.
I wish I had better news
for you. Because the bishops are in charge.
Well, the church in Germany, in many respects, is sort of the mirror opposite of the church in the United States. It tends to be far more to the left, far less traditional. And I think in the United States, even though maybe traditional is not the right way to describe the bishops here, I think they tend to be far more traditional than not. But Germany seems to be sort of the inverse of that. So when it comes to leadership among the German bishops, I'm not seeing anything that I can see anyway that suggests that some of the more prominent archbishops are trying to rein that kind of thing in. I haven't seen that. Cardinal Mueller, who is German, he was the prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith until just recently. He has made an effort to do that, but even his efforts at that high level were ignored. So I don't see any sign right now that we're likely to see a correction of those types of problems. I wish I had different news for you, but that's what it looks like to me.
So no excommunication, that's not possible.
Oh, it's possible. Sure, it's possible. But I don't think it's likely to happen under the current circumstances.
Oh. Okay, well, thank you very much for answering my question.
You're welcome. Sorry to send you away disappointed, but that's how things look to me. We should pray, right? We'll pray for everybody involved. That's for sure. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Lori in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment about your earlier talk with the recording about the interviewer repeating, "Are you clear? Are we clear?"
Yeah.
And repeating her statement that there was no such education.
Right.
In the early 70s, I applied for a job where the boss insisted we all take this Scientology course.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that they taught us, was just keep repeating your point regardless of what the other person was saying, and to say, "Are we clear? Are we clear?" Obviously, I quit that job once I found out what Scientology was about. But anyway, that's what that interview reminded me of.
Yeah, I could see that. Going Clear is actually the name of an expose movie that you can see online. It's probably carried on Netflix, maybe, or Amazon Prime.
We clear.
But, well, in the Scientology sense. So going clear, what they mean by that is where all of your bad ethics and your the thought-stopping problems that you have as a human being are removed through the process of auditing. And then when you get clear, you have reached that sort of status. And everybody has to pay to try to get to that point, and nobody ever really seems to get to that point, from what I can tell. So if you're interested in seeing that documentary about Scientology, that's what it's called. Okay,
thank you.
All right, you're welcome, Lori. Good to talk to you. Let's go now to Ann in Chicago. Good morning, Ann.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
A few years back, I was in Prague, and they had two things there that interested me that I didn't understand. The first was sort of a grave thing, statue thing, which was described as the Dormition of Mary.
Right.
And they had the House of Loretto that they said was from Loretto. And so my question is whether Mary was just sleeping before she was assumed, or whether she passed away before she assumed, or whether the church says we don't know, but either way, she's in heaven. And so that I'm worried, I'm concerned. Well, I don't know. I'm just curious about that. And then they also have this Infant of Prague doll, which is, I think, weird. So I'm interested in your thoughts about what they have back there in the old country in Prague.
In the old country, right. Well, the Infant of Prague is an image of the way in which the eyewitnesses said that Jesus appeared as a child. So Jesus, of course, can appear however he wishes. And so if he does appear to somebody in the form of how he looked when he was a little boy or whatever, that's his prerogative. So the history of that image is based upon what people said he was wearing and what did he look like when he had that apparition. So that would be the first part. I don't know how much more I could say on that particular issue. So like Our Lady Guadalupe, she's portrayed in a certain way on the tilma because that's how she chose to appear to St. Juan Diego. But I know what you mean, like a little doll of a boy with a costume on and a big robe and all that. I mean, I could understand why, especially for us now in the 21st century, we don't dress that way. We don't, you know, it seems so foreign to us. I could see why it might strike you as a little bit odd. But back in those days, it was certainly very much in keeping with how a prince would look, how a prince would dress. And so it would not have seemed strange to them. Now, as far as Mary's Dormition is concerned, the word Dormition, it is an anglicized version of the Latin, which means to sleep. And we see Jesus himself using this term about Lazarus in John chapter 11, beginning in verse 11. He says, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him." Now, this is a euphemism, and you see this euphemism used throughout the New Testament, that so-and-so has fallen asleep in the Lord. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, it says, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as others do." And it's talking about those who have fallen asleep. It's, again, the euphemism for dying. But it really does mean dying. And one way we can know that is that Lazarus, and when Jesus raised him from the dead, that would not have been a miracle if he actually had merely been asleep. You know, you and I were asleep not that long ago. Only several hours ago, we were asleep, but we're awake now. So in this context, that phrase falling asleep or being asleep, that literally means death. So these people have died. So the Dormition of Mary is a way of using that, the term the Dormition of Mary is a way of using that biblical motif of falling asleep, but it doesn't preclude death. It means that at some point at the end of her life, Mary ceased living this mortal life, and shortly thereafter, the Lord raised her body and soul and assumed her into heaven. So unlike Jesus, who ascended to heaven under his own power, God himself assumed Mary into heaven, body and soul. So she did fall asleep, but in the biblical sense.
And okay, so she died first and then was assumed. Yes, right. That helps very much. Thank you.
You're most welcome, man. Good to chat with you. How about a break, and then we'll come back and we'll do more of the Patrick Madrid Show, including your phone calls. Also, I want to share with you a message that Archbishop Gomez recently gave at a congress in Spain, and it has a direct bearing on things like what we've talked about here, critical race theory, gender ideology, and other things like that. I want to share the essence of his remarks with you so that you're aware of them, and we will also do more phone calls. You're listening to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We are back. Thanks for listening. I want to share with you right now an address that Archbishop Jose Gomez of Los Angeles gave at a Congress of Catholics and Public Life Folk in Madrid just a few days ago. So this is the English translation of what he gave in Spanish. The title is Reflections on the Church and America's New Religions. And you may say, new religions? What's that? Well, he's talking about, as you'll see, the ideologies that are running amok in this country right now. We've talked a little bit about critical race theory as one example. We've talked a little bit about gender ideology. Well, we talked more than a little bit about that. And there are other things, you know, something that's known as wokeism, being woke. And I just feel like I should put my two cents in here first. In one sense, the word woke is entirely acceptable insofar as it means that you become aware of, for example, racial injustice and racism. And to the extent that there is a supremacy exerted by one racial group over another, which is wrong, that too. So being woke in that sense, maybe that's the more traditional or the older sense of the term, I completely accept that meaning, and I endorse it. We should be aware of, we should be awake to the problems in our culture, and racism is certainly a big problem. And as I say, and I'll continue to say, is that racism is always wrong, no matter what color the skin of the person is who's committing the act of racism is. So racism is not unique to any particular racial group. It's not solely the fault of a certain skin color group. It's a human problem. This is one of the serious shortcomings, one of the serious deficiencies of the so-called critical race theory, is that it doesn't take that reality into account. And it asserts that certain people, simply by virtue of their skin color, are implicated in a racism that they may have, personally speaking, nothing to do with. And they, you know, they're condemned because they benefited from structures of racism, etc. So this is, there's not enough time, obviously, to delve into all of those matters. But I do want to at least acknowledge that there is a certain sense in which that term woke can be understood and even accepted. We should be awake to these problems. We should condemn them. We should denounce them. We should oppose them. We should speak out against them. And oddly enough, that would encompass those who under the guise of being so-called anti-racists, actually are racists. It's just that their racism is directed to a different group of people. And that's part of the problem with critical race theory. So Archbishop Jose Gomez says the following. He says, "You have asked me to address a serious, sensitive, and complicated topic, the rise of new secular ideologies and movements for social change in the United States and the implications for the church. And of course, I think we all understand that what the church is facing in the United States is also happening in your country." Again, he's speaking in Spain. "And in the countries throughout Europe, in different degrees and in different ways. With that understanding, I want to offer my reflections today in three parts. First, I want to talk about the wider context of the global movement of secularization and de-Christianization and the impact of the pandemic. Second, I want to offer a spiritual interpretation of the new social justice and political identity movements in America. Finally, I want to suggest some evangelical priorities for the church as we confront the realities of the present moment." Number one, he says, "I think we all know that while there are unique conditions in the United States, similar broad patterns of aggressive secularization have long been at work in Spain and elsewhere in Europe. An elite leadership class has risen in our countries that has little interest in religion and no real attachments to the nations that they live in or to local traditions and cultures. This group, which is in charge in corporations, governments, universities, the media, and in the cultural and professional establishments, wants to establish what we might call a global civilization, built on a consumer economy and guided by science, technology, humanitarian values, and technocratic ideas about organizing society. In this elite worldview, there is no need for old-fashioned belief systems and religions. In fact, as they see it, religion, especially Christianity, only gets in the way of the society they hope to build. That is important to remember. In practice, as our popes have pointed out, secularization means de-Christianization. For years now, there has been a deliberate effort in Europe and America to erase the Christian roots of society and to suppress any remaining Christian influences. In your program for this Congress, you allude to cancel culture and political correctness, and we recognize that often what is being canceled and corrected are perspectives rooted in Christian beliefs, beliefs about human life and the human person, about marriage, the family, and more. In your society and mine, the space that the church and believing Christians are permitted to occupy is shrinking. Church institutions and Christian-owned businesses are increasingly challenged and harassed. The same is true for Christians working in education, healthcare, government, and other sectors. Holding certain Christian beliefs is said to be a threat to the freedoms and even to the safety of other groups in our society. One more point of context. We all noticed the dramatic social changes in our societies with the coming of the coronavirus and the way our government authorities responded to the pandemic. I think history will look back and see that this pandemic did not change our societies as much as it accelerated trends and directions that were already at work. Social changes that might have taken decades to play out are now moving more rapidly in the wake of this disease and our society's responses. This is certainly true in the United States. And by the way, to pause, I'm reading to you the English translation of an address that Archbishop Jose Gomez gave to a Congress of pro-life and other leaders in Spain about a week or so ago. He says, "The new social movements and ideologies that we are talking about today were being seeded and prepared for many years in our universities and cultural institutions. But with the tension and fear caused by the pandemic and social isolation, and with the killing of an unarmed black man by a white policeman and the protests that followed in our cities," he's talking about George Floyd, of course, "these movements were fully unleashed in our society. This context is important in understanding our situation in the United States. The name George Floyd is now known worldwide. But that is because for many people in my country, myself included, His tragedy became a stark reminder that racial and economic inequality are still deeply embedded in our society. We need to keep this reality of inequality in mind, because these movements that we are talking about are part of a wider discussion, a discussion that is absolutely essential about how to build an American society that expands opportunities for everyone, no matter what color their skin is, or where they came from, or their economic status. With that, let's turn to my next point, America's new political religions. He says, here is my thesis. I believe the best way for the church to understand the new social justice movements is to understand them as pseudo-religions, and even replacements and rivals to traditional Christian beliefs. With the breakdown of the Judeo-Christian worldview and the rise of secularism, political belief systems based on social justice or personal identity have come to fill the space that Christian belief and practice once occupied. Whatever we call these movements, social justice, wokeness, identity politics, intersectionality, successor ideology, they claim to offer what religion provides. They provide people with an explanation for events and conditions in the world. They offer a sense of meaning, a purpose for living, and the feeling of belonging to a community. Even more than that, like Christianity, these new movements tell their own quote-unquote story of salvation. To explain what I mean, let me try to briefly compare the Christian story with what we might call the woke story or the social justice story. I'm going to pause here for a second. A few moments ago, you heard me saying that there is a legitimate way of saying the word woke, or I should say it this way. There is a legitimate meaning, an acceptable meaning to the word woke, if you consider it in its historical context. In other words, what has it meant, generally speaking, until recent years? Generally speaking, the term, especially in the Black community, meant to be aware of, and this is not limited to this, but it's a big part of it, to be aware of, cognizant of, and working against the racism that has been so deeply embedded in many aspects of American culture. Slavery itself, for example, the Jim Crow laws, the unjust oppression of Black people and other minorities. These are all facts, and we shouldn't try to deny it. We shouldn't try to sweep it under the rug or minimize it. They have to be condemned, and they have to be fought against. So when he's talking about wokeism here, or when he uses the word woke, he's not using it in that context. He's using it in the context, and this, of course, is my interpretation. Archbishop Gomez did not say this to me, but as I read this document, this is how I interpret it. He's using it in the sense, the twisted, and I would argue aberrant sense of the term, that entails things like critical race theory in its more popularized form, which is just another form of racism. It's masquerading as anti-racism, but it perpetrates the evil of racism, in this case, just against a different group of people. And since we've talked about it before, I don't feel the need to go into the whys and wherefores, except to say he's identifying the way in which this this term has been weaponized, if you ask me, and turned into a way of bullying and coercing people, often through fear and intimidation tactics. And so he's identifying the problematic way in which this term is being used. I want to make that part really clear. Again, this is my interpretation. He says, the Christian story in its simplest form goes something like this. We are created in the image of God and called to a blessed life in union with Him and with our neighbors. Human life has a God-given telos, an intention, a direction. Through our sin, we are alienated from God and from one another, and we live in the shadow of our own death. By the mercy of God and His love for each of us, we are saved through the dying and rising of Jesus Christ. Jesus reconciles us to God and our neighbors, gives us the grace to be transformed in His image, and calls us to follow Him in faith, loving God and our neighbor, working to build His kingdom on earth, all in confident hope that we will have eternal life with Him in the world to come. That's the Christian story. And now, more than ever, the church and every Catholic needs to know this story and proclaim it in all its beauty and truth. We need to do that because there is another story out there today, a rival, quote-unquote, salvation narrative that we hear being told in the media and in our institutions by the new social justice movements. What we might call the woke story goes something like this. We cannot know where we come from, but we are aware that we have interests in common with those who share our skin color or our position in society. We are also painfully aware that our group is suffering and alienated through no fault of our own. The cause of our unhappiness is that we are victims of oppression by other groups in society. We are liberated and find redemption through our constant struggle against our oppressors by waging a battle for political and cultural power in the name of creating a society of equity. I'm going to pause there for a second. What he's saying here is a very close approximation of Marxism. It's just that the Marxist class struggle between the proletariat, which would be the unwashed masses, the poor people generally, and those who have control of society, those who are wealthy, not to mention the bourgeois people who have money because they're middle class, the essential building blocks of Marxist ideology are class struggle. And looking at the other class as your oppressor and therefore to be hated and therefore to be fought against. So the Marxist dialectic that it's at the very heart of communism is what he's pointing out. He's pointing out, without using those words, he's pointing out that there is a very strong resemblance between the two. So he says, clearly, and he's again, he's depicting how you might tell the story of these pseudo-religions, or as he puts it today, the story that is being told by these rival salvation narratives. He says, clearly, this is a powerful and attractive narrative for millions of people in American society and in societies across the West. In fact, many of America's leading corporations, universities, and even public schools are actively promoting and teaching this vision. This story draws its strength from the simplicity of its explanations. The world is divided into innocents and victims, allies and adversaries. But this narrative is also attractive because, as I said earlier, it responds to real human needs and suffering. People are hurting. They do feel discriminated against and excluded from opportunities in society. We should never forget this. Many of those who subscribe to these new movements and belief systems are motivated by noble intentions. They want to change conditions in society that deny men and women their rights and opportunities for a good life. Of course, we all want to build a society that provides equality, freedom, and dignity for every person. But we can only build a just society on the foundation of truth about God and human nature. This has been the constant teaching of our church and her popes for nearly two centuries now. Our emeritus Pope Benedict XVI warned that the eclipse of God leads to the eclipse of the human person. Again and again, he told us, when we forget God, we no longer see the image of God in our neighbor. Pope Francis makes the same point powerfully in Fratelli Tutti. Unless we believe that God is our Father, there is no reason for us to treat others as our brothers and sisters. That, Archbishop Gomez says, is precisely the problem here. Today's critical theories and ideologies are profoundly atheistic. They deny the soul, the spiritual, transcendent dimension of human nature, or they think that it is irrelevant to human happiness. They reduce what it means to be human essentially to physical qualities, the color of your skin, or sex, or notions of gender, or ethnic background, or position in society. No doubt that we can recognize in these movements certain elements of liberation theology. They seem to be coming from the same Marxist cultural vision. Also, these movements resemble some of the heresies that we find in church history. Like the early Manichaeans, these movements see the world as a struggle between forces of good and the forces of evil. Like the Gnostics, they reject creation in the body. They seem to believe that human beings can become whatever we decide to make of ourselves. These movements are also Pelagian, believing that redemption can be accomplished through our own human efforts without God. And as a final point, I would note that these movements are utopian. They seem to really believe that we can create a kind of heaven on earth, a perfectly just society through our own political efforts. Again, my friends, my point is this. I believe that it is important for the church to understand and engage these new movements, not on social or political terms, but as dangerous substitutes for true religion. In denying God, these new movements have lost the truth about the human person. This explains their extremism and their harsh, uncompromising, and unforgiving approach to politics. And from the standpoint of the gospel, because these movements deny the human person, no matter how well-intentioned they are, they cannot promote authentic human flourishing. In fact, as we are witnessing in my country, these strictly secular movements are causing new forms of social division, discrimination, intolerance, and injustice. So the third part, he says, what is to be done? My final set of reflections, he says, the question is, what is to be done? How should the church respond to these new secular movements for social change? My answer, he says, is simple. We need to proclaim Jesus Christ, boldly, creatively. We need to tell our story of salvation in a new way, with charity and confidence, without fear. This is the church's mission in every age and every cultural moment. We should not be intimidated by these new religions of social justice and political identity. The gospel remains the most powerful force for social change that the world has ever seen, and the church has been anti-racist from the beginning. All are included in her message of salvation. Jesus Christ came to announce the new creation, the new man and the new woman, given power to become children of God, renewed in the image of their Creator. Jesus taught us to know and love God as our Father, and he called his church to carry that good news to the ends of the earth, to gather from every race and tribe and people the one worldwide family of God. That was the meaning of Pentecost, when men and women from every nation under heaven heard the gospel in their own native language. That is what St. Paul meant when he said that in Christ there is no Jew or Greek, male or female, slave or free. Of course, in the church, we have not always lived up to our beautiful principles or carried out the mission entrusted to us by Christ, but the world does not need a new secular religion to replace Christianity. It needs you and me to be better witnesses, better Christians. Let us begin by forgiving, loving, sacrificing for others, putting away spiritual poisons like resentment and envy. Personally, he says, I find inspiration in the saints and holy figures in my country's histories, referring to the United States, and also perhaps Mexico. He says, in this moment, I am looking especially to the servant of God, Dorothy Day. For me, she offers an important witness for how Catholics can work to change our social order through radical detachment and love for the poor, grounded in the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, and the works of mercy. She also had a keen sense that before we can change the hearts of others, we have to change ourselves. She once said, I see only too clearly how bad people are. I wish I did not see it so. It is my own sins that give me such clarity. But I cannot worry much about your sins and miseries when I have so many of my own. My prayer from day to day is that God will so enlarge my heart that I will see you all and live with you all in his love. The Archbishop says, this is the attitude that we need right now when our society is so polarized and divided. I am also drawing inspiration from the witness of Venerable Augustus Tolton. He is an amazing and truly American story. He was born in slavery, escaped into freedom with his mother, and became the first black man to be ordained a priest in my country. Father Tolton once said, the Catholic Church deplores a double slavery, that of the mind and that of the body. She endeavors to free us of both. Archbishop Gomez says, today we need this confidence in the power of the gospel. We are at risk right now of sliding into a new tribalism, a pre-Christian idea of humanity as divided into competing groups and factions. We need to live and proclaim the gospel as the true path to liberation from every slavery and injustice, spiritual and material, in our preaching and practice, and especially in our love for our neighbors. We need to bear witness to God's beautiful vision of our common humanity, our common origin, and common destiny in God. Finally, he says, in this hour, I think the church must be a voice for individual conscience and tolerance. We need to promote greater humility and realism about the human condition. Acknowledging our common humanity means recognizing our common frailty. The truth is that we are all sinners, people who want to do the right thing but often do not. That does not mean we remain passive in the face of social injustice. Never. But we do need to insist that fraternity cannot be built through animosity or division. True religion does not seek to harm or humiliate, to ruin livelihoods or reputations. True religion offers a path for even the worst sinners to find redemption. One last thought, he says, and that is the reality of God's providence. We need to hold on to the supernatural understanding because it is true. God's loving hand still guides our lives in the course of nations. In the United States, the Church is preparing to celebrate next month the 490th anniversary of the apparitions of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which marks the true spiritual founding of America. And already we are seeing signs of an authentic religious awakening going on in America. Underneath all the controversy of our politics, the continued clouds of the pandemic, all the uncertainty about where our country is headed, I'm confident that we will see the spiritual awakening grow and spread in the coming decade as we look ahead to the 500th anniversary of the apparition. And Our Lady's words at Tepeyac continue to strengthen and inspire me. Am I not here, I who am your mother? Are you not in my shadow, under my protection? So he concludes by saying, thank you for your invitation and for listening today. May God bless you all, and may Our Lady of Guadalupe continue to intercede for us. Well done. That's the address that Archbishop Gomez gave to the Congress in Spain. I have a few more thoughts about that. Perhaps you do too. Give me a call, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, longer. Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. So if you're just tuning in right now, you missed, I was sharing verbatim the entire message that Archbishop Jose Gomez of Los Angeles delivered just within the last week at a pro-life Congress in Spain. It's well worth your time to read it. He speaks the truth in very measured and in effective ways. And I'd like you to have the chance to read it. I read it to you, but you can get the link to it on my show Twitter, on my Twitter feed rather, at Patrick Madrid. If Cyrus retweets it, you'll be able to grab it if you prefer by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. But it's there in its entirety. It's the English language version. And I encourage you not only to read it and to think about it and pray about it, but also to share it with others. Very, very helpful and very well-timed. Let's go to Cesar now in Harlingen, Texas. Good morning, Cesar.
How you doing, Patrick? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a pretty simple question. One of the things I've always, we're doing our house cleaning, we're going, getting rid of stuff that we don't need. And we came upon a couple of books that we had in our house. One was Interpretation of Dreams. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, and I've asked a couple of people, I get kind of questionable responses, but is that something we should even have in our house? Would that be allowable?
Well, yeah, I think it would. I mean, of course, it would depend upon who wrote it and what perspective they're coming from. So we know that dreams are an important way that God speaks to us in some cases. So okay. Joseph in Egypt, he interpreted dreams for the king. We know that God spoke through the angel that gave St. Joseph the dream to get up and take Mary and Jesus into Egypt. So dreams are in themselves is part of the human condition, and it's also part of revelation that God uses for us. So there's nothing inherently wrong with that topic, but if you judge that the book is approaching it from maybe a New Age approach or something like that, that'd be a different story. I wouldn't have that if I detected that problem. And keep in mind, too, that just because somebody writes a book about interpreting dreams, that may or may not be accurate information. You know, it's probably right. More their opinion than anything else. But I don't see any inherent harm in it.
How about a book on, like, birthdays? I had one that compares, like, somebody, like, say, two people from December together, for example, or describes. I mean, you can look at, like, if you're having a date, like, are you going on a date, you can actually look at what their birthday is and yours and see if that's compatible with that. Something you could also have, or that's also, would that be a no-no?
Well, that sounds to me like it's more horoscope-based. You know,
right.
if the birthday is then, like, no. What sign are you? Is that what it is?
I think it's kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah. I think horoscopes are nonsense.
No, right?
I think, well, I mean, you don't need an ethical permission slip from me, Cesar, but I mean, if you're asking me what I would do, I would toss something like that because I don't believe in horoscopes.
Okay.
I think they're bunk. So.
Yeah, good. I agree with you. And I don't really, you know, and even the comment about St. Joseph, someone told me that since that was before Jesus, right? That was the Old Testament before, you know, and that when Jesus came, you don't need to really even think about the future. So it's really, there's no real purpose in interpreting dreams anymore. Would that be true?
No, that's not true.
No,
it's not. Okay. Because take, for example, in Acts chapter 10, God reveals the cessation or the abrogation of the Mosaic covenant kosher food laws and unclean animals in the form of a dream. So it's a revelation from God, but it comes to St. Peter in the form of a dream. And then that dream is interpreted and then promulgated five chapters later in Acts chapter 15 at the Council of Jerusalem. So there's definitely a place for dreams. You know, maybe not a major place anymore, but
right.
There's certainly a place for it, yeah.
Well, thank you. That's a very good explanation. It really helps me out.
I'm glad. I appreciate the phone call. It's an important topic. Thank you. How about Ann now in Chicago? Good morning, Ann.
Morning, Patrick. My comment and maybe question is this. Why are we so up in arms, our Catholic community, about Joe Biden? I think that, and I'm not a Joe Biden fan, but I do believe that just by, you wouldn't say virtue, but just by condition of his sin regarding abortion, he is excommunicated. I went through something, an examination of conscience, and I found that to be stated there in the examination of conscience that anyone who, well, we know the drill, seeks, gets, obtains an abortion, and anyone connected with helping that along is committing a grave crime and sin, and that they are excommunicated until they go to confession and receive a special blessing. And John Paul II...
And I'm very familiar with this topic, so you don't need to explain it to me, but did you have a question about this?
Yeah, I guess why is the... why isn't that being confirmed by our bishop, saying, well, we really don't have to do... It should be... I mean, is he excommunicated by virtue of what he's doing? I think he is.
Well, I am not a canon lawyer, so I can't speak with any authority, but I do know how to read. And when I read the pertinent sections on this topic, it sure seems to me that if the woman who gets an abortion is thereby excommunicated, and the abortion doctor, if he happens to be Catholic, and other people who are party to her procuring the abortion, if this laete sententiae excommunication is incurred, then it certainly seems to me that it would be incurred by any Catholic politician who promotes it and legislates it and all the other things that go into that. I would say that it sure seems to me that they are affected by this as well. But not being a bishop, I don't have any standing in this area. I can't do anything about it. That's something that only the bishops can do. And for some reason, it seems in many cases they are unwilling.
Reluctant.
To say the least. Yeah, maybe unwilling might be another way to put it. But beyond that, I don't know what else to tell you.
Well, I mean, there's nothing to tell other than I just confirmed to people around. Now, I want to be clear that I don't want to spread gossip or scandal, but that when they say something to me, I say, well, he is excommunicated. There's no two ways about it. And if people don't want to say it, they just are trying to stay out of, you know, the line of fire.
Yeah, fair enough.
Come on, man.
I don't know what else I can tell you. So if the church's law means anything, then by my reading of that law, you're correct. And, you know, the law is either there to be, the law is either there to guide us and protect us, or it's not. And the natural question that I think arises in people's minds is, well, if people can just simply flout the law and ignore it, and what other laws can they ignore? And if they can ignore any given law, then why not all the laws? Why have a law at all if it's not going to be enforced? Those are questions that I think are reasonable to ask under the current circumstances. Thank you, Aunt. Let's go to Larry quickly in Roswell, New Mexico. Hi, Larry.
Thank you. My question is, a conversation I've had with someone recently saying that C.S. Lewis states that heaven is on earth. And I have a problem with that in that the Jehovah's Witnesses decided when heaven was full of their 144,000, they also claim that heaven is on earth because heaven couldn't fit anyone else. So they changed their doctrine.
No, they really didn't do that. They call it paradise earth. And so they have their belief is different from what you're saying. They do believe in a literal heaven where Jehovah God is present, but the 144,000 will be up there. Everyone else will be on paradise earth. So there are two distinct locations, heaven and paradise earth. They're not the same place. Larry.
So, yes.
Okay. I've got about a minute left. I don't want to run out of time with you. Did you have more you want to
say? Where does C.S. Lewis stand on it? Does he preach that heaven is on earth?
I never saw anything from C.S. Lewis to that effect. I mean, the closest I've come to that is Belinda Carlisle's song, where she sings heaven is a place on earth. I don't believe that either. But
okay, good.
Yeah, I'm not aware of C.S. Lewis saying that.
Okay, thank you. And then
I got to go. I'm out of time, I'm afraid, Larry. Forgive me. But we are down to the last few seconds of the show. I wanted to say thank you to everybody for listening to the program today. I do appreciate it. Everything I talk about on the show, Cyrus gets links to it, at least the books and articles and things, so you can read it for yourself. We're clear. Yeah,
right.
Check that out on the show Twitter feed. We're clear. Yeah, we're clear. And we'll be back to doing this again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. You can find everything on the show Twitter feed at relevantradio.com/Patrick. I'll be with you again tomorrow, God willing. Until then, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me.